everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2021, and this is a momentous episode. This is episode 250, which is a conversation about recovering the argument for the existence of God from beauty. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Tallon, who is with us all the way back at episode number one. Phil is the Dean of the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's also the author or editor of several books, including The Poetics of Evil. Phil has written a feature article for an upcoming print edition of the Christian Research Journal. His article is in volume 44, number 3, and it's called From Beauty to the Beatific Vision, Recovering the Argument from Beauty. You can read his article if you're a subscriber to our magazine. If not, and you'd like to read the article, please head on over to our website, equip.org, to subscribe. Phil, it's good to have you on.
Ah, always a pleasure to be here.
Well, of course, it's momentous to have Phil on this particular episode because we've just hit 250 episodes, and Phil was there all the way back at episode number one, 5 years ago. So I always enjoy having Phil on at those big milestones at, you know, 50, 100, 150, 200, and now 250. So I'm really glad that you're here. And we're here, as I mentioned, to talk about his article that's forthcoming in the last issue of this year. So it's a little bit of a sneak peek as to what's coming up. But Phil wrote an in-depth article for us on the argument for beauty for the existence of God. And so, you know, this is not an apologetic, something that's kind of a go-to argument for the Christian apologist. And so why don't you just kind of set the foundation for this? You know, obviously, beauty is very important. We are currently more in an image versus word-driven culture. But just taking a step back, you know, because beauty is more than image, what is beauty?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, it's I'm always happy to talk about the argument. I do think it's an argument that has a lot of intuitive, you know, force for people. I think people just sort of naturally resonate with it, but it doesn't come up a lot in philosophical circles. Maybe that's just because beauty is a little bit, you know, hard to pin down, and philosophers like to be able to pin down their definitions. But as I use the term beauty, I think typically as it's used, what we're talking about is something that's aesthetically good. And so by aesthetic, we mean sort of good according to the senses, you know, what you perceive. And so that's where the term aesthetics comes from. And so beauty, well, we often kind of equate it perhaps with what you might call prettiness. You know, typically it's a kind of a broad concept and, you know, encompassing sort of all things that are aesthetically good, perhaps, you know, distinct in some ways from what some philosophers kind of refer to as the distinction between the beautiful and the sublime. So the sublime is sort of tremendous, huge, you know, maybe terrifying in some ways. You might think about, you know, an incredibly immense, you know, mountain range looming above you. You're still in awe of it. It's still good in some ways, but it's kind of scary. Whereas the beautiful is aesthetically good and evokes desire in us, you know, some way that we want to be united to this thing. And so I think this can apply everything from the beautiful flower that you want to look at and smell, or beautiful person that you just kind of enjoy being the presence of, to even things that are perhaps dangerous to us, but still evoke a kind of a desire. So I think a lot of us can resonate with, you know, being at the zoo and seeing a lion or a tiger and thinking that it's very beautiful and that we would love to be able to pet it, be in its presence, even when we recognize that doing so would be very foolish, right? It'd be dangerous. So beauty is that which evokes desire. It's that which is aesthetically good. And that's how I'm using the term.
You know, there's the, I guess, the phrase that everybody knows about beauty being in the eye of the beholder, which suggests that beauty could be subjective. And when we think of beauty as also being something being lovely, is your definition of beauty, just kind of having you expand on what you just said, something that would be beautiful to all people, that everyone would recognize that it's beautiful? Because it seems like such a subjective thing. Some people think certain things are lovely and other people don't find that aesthetically pleasing.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think it's a very common sort of objection. I get this a lot. You know, when I talk about, you know, beauty, people say, but wait, isn't beauty just, you know, sort of something that goes with taste, and there's really no, as the Latin said, de gustibus non disputandum, about matters of taste, there's really no good arguing. And, you know, so maybe it's the case that actually everybody has their own sense of what's aesthetically good, and that it's so different that really it's, when we talk about beauty, we should just be talking about kind of internal states or something like that, our own personal reactions. And now I disagree with this view. I think that actually the evidence, you know, of the ages shows that there's great consensus about very beautiful things, you know, so we have a kind of over time, the cream rises to the top. So the, you know, the great works of art, you know, continue to fascinate us and draw us. And there's incredible agreement about the, you know, which wonders of the world and which artists are truly worth reflecting on. And then, you know, likewise, often what we think might be major artistic disagreements are really rather minor when you get more sophisticated language. So, you know, I think that sometimes people might, you know, talk about preference for different sorts of personal beauty, you know, sort of attractiveness. So I'm attracted to this and I'm attracted to that. And, you know, so we all have our different types. And so this is a sort of a metaphor for the larger example of different tastes. But I think if we reflect a little bit more deeply and sort of, you know, take into account our own kind of just life experiences and so forth, you understand why we have some of these different preferences. And you say, oh, well, if I had had some different experiences, I probably would be more attuned to different sorts of beauty than I am. So a little bit of reflection, a little bit of digging, a little bit of time often, I think, reveals that there is, in fact, great consensus about beauty. So disagreements about the beautiful are greatly overrated. But I think there's an even deeper reason why Christians should not be drawn to the view that beauty is subjective, because we affirm the objectivity of a lot of things that about which there's disagreement. So people disagree about ethical questions in our world today. You know, some people say, well, I think that this course of action is right. And Christians may say, oh, no, and, you know, it's very wrong. Now, I think it'd be silly for us to say, oh, people disagree about morality, so therefore morality is just subjective, right? It's just about personal taste, really. So we affirm objectivity of morality. It's something about which you can be right or wrong. We affirm the sort of objectivity of truth, right? We think that there are certain just truths. Things are, you know, true or false, even if people disagree about them. And so it strikes me that beauty should be in that category as well. We would affirm the objectivity of beauty. So it's strange to me that Christians kind of resist cultural relativism about truth and goodness, but then they fall into cultural relativism when it comes to matters of taste. That just seems strange and unusual, and I think we should be skeptical of people who think that beauty is just an eye of the beholder.
So your article particularly is, of course, as I mentioned, the argument from beauty for the existence of God. And, you know, it's something that has been around for a long time, but what is it particularly? What is the argument from beauty? Because like we mentioned at the start of this, it's not something that, you know, when you're talking about the existence of God, it's not a go-to kind of argument that most apologists think of.
Yeah, I think it's becoming more and more popular, but it is a little bit off the beaten path, you know. And so there are different ways you can formulate an argument from beauty, right? I think one of the most intuitive is to offer it as a kind of a version of the design argument, right? So in the same way that when we see something that's incredibly complex, but yet, you know, unified and produces, you know, something that's very hard to do if we were designing it ourselves, we can then intuit, you know, some great, brilliant designer was at work, you know, kind of classic, you know, Paley's wristwatch, you know, or pocket watch. We can intuit design when we see it. And you can similarly do so for the beautiful. So when we look at the world around us, I mean, imagine a beautiful sunrise kind of, you know, painted over the ocean or a mountain range or a woodland scene. You go, oh my goodness, this is so incredibly beautiful. You know, that's amazing. And then you think, you know, it's really hard to make things that are beautiful. If I were to do a painting of this, even just copying it, I wouldn't be able to capture the beauty. And certainly if I was trying to invent something equally as beautiful, it'd be incredibly difficult. And so we can use a sort of artistic analogy and say, you know, just even with intention and work, it's hard for us to create beautiful things. Yet, the natural world is just abundant with not just normal amounts of beauty, but we would say great beauty. And so you can move then from this analogy to say, so therefore, you know, this suggests that there is a great artist, as it were, behind the scenes who has created this world, because, you know, natural things don't possess kind of intentionality of their own to produce these. You know, the sunset is not trying to make things beautiful. And so we then move from the created world to a creator. And you find versions of this thinking, you know, back in Plato, and early Christian theologians and apologists offer similar sorts of arguments. So Athenagoras is a second century Athenian, and he compares the universe to like an instrument that's tuned and being played, right? There's this harmony within creation, a kind of a beautiful order. And so then we naturally then move to think about God as being the master artist, you know, who has tuned this instrument and is plucking it. So that's one kind of intuitive version, I think, that most people are drawn to. One thing you find is that actually a lot of atheist people are skeptical about God's existence for other reasons, kind of moved by the argument from beauty, right? Beauty evokes wonder in them, awe, admiration. Maybe even they see it as counting as evidence, just insufficient evidence for God's existence.
This is episode 250 of the Postmodern Realities podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Philip Tallon. He has written a feature article in our upcoming print edition, volume 44, number 3. His article is called From Beauty to the Beatific Vision, Recovering the Argument from Beauty. You can read his article when you subscribe to our magazine at our website, equip.org. As I've mentioned for the past several episodes and will continue to mention, please get in on getting a free subscription to our journal for yourself or for a family member or maybe even your pastor by just simply leaving us a comment on Apple Podcasts. If you give us a star review, we're super thankful. But for anyone who actually writes out a short 1 to 2 sentence review about why they listen to this podcast and why they enjoy it, you can be entered in to win if we get to 100 reviews by the end of this year, by the end of December 2021. So I hope that you will join in on that contest, and it only literally takes a couple moments of your time to head on over to do that. And I mentioned that you can be subscribing to our magazine for $33.50 at our website, equip.org. But if you are not having that amount in your budget right now, but would like to give us a tip to help us continue to bring you these podcasts and all this content for free, would you please go over to our website, equip.org, go to magazine at the drop down, Postmodern Realities. And if you click on any landing page, including this one, you can find a link where you could give us a tip for $3 or $5 or some other small amount, because they all add up to help us to meet our budget for the Christian Research Journal. And we just want you to know that the best way you can help us out is just tell a friend. Please put this episode up on your social media feeds, or just tell a friend that you know why you enjoy this podcast and why they should subscribe. And thank you for your partnership. You're just explaining to us the particular argument from beauty for the existence of God. But how do you answer, you know, you mentioned atheists, like, for instance, Richard Dawkins in his, I guess it's now classic, came out in the 2000s, 2006 book, The God Delusion, said that that argument really has no there. It's nothing that's logical at all to talk about beauty or art or anything in relationship to the existence of God. So, you know, how does a Christian apologist answer someone like Dawkins is saying, well, it's just not really a sound argument. It's nothing really.
Well, there are certainly atheists who disagree with Dawkins, for one. So people like Paul Draper, you know, see beauty as counting for evidence. So there are multiple ways one could object to, you know, the argument from beauty. You could say that the term beauty is just elusive and meaningless, and so there's really no kind of, you know, purpose in leaning on that. And so I think one could then shore up, okay, well, here's what we mean by beauty. one doesn't even necessarily have to make an argument from objective beauty. You could just say, well, there's so many experiences of beautiful things in the world, and there's no, you know, no real reason that we would think that great amounts of beauty would occur given naturalism, right? So it's a kind of the easiest version of the argument in some ways is just to offer beauty as evidence for God. You don't even have to say that it's, you know, conclusive evidence. You can just say, well, this is just more evidence that shows that the existence of God is likely. And so if there's a world that comes about, sort of the world as we see it as a result of basically kind of random and undesigned processes, you know, what likelihood do we think that there would, you know, that the world would exhibit great amounts of beauty? You know, that's, so I think that it's pretty intuitive to say that it's fairly low chance of that, certainly lower than on Christian theism, which says that God is, you know, unified and complex and beautiful and would create a world that reflects that in some way. So you can just kind of compare these two options against sort of the experience of beauty, the evidence of beauty that's before us, and see which one is more likely. So it's a little bit like, you know, if you came home one day and you found that there was a heavy boulder rolled in front of your front door with a bow on top of it, you would be very perplexed by this. So you go, well, what explains this boulder? So, you know, you could think through some various options. One is that the boulder just kind of rolled there by itself or fell out of the sky, you know. But why does it have the bow on it? Seems strange. That's still possible, right? It's possible that something like that could happen. But let's say you also know that you have a friend who is a champion bodybuilder and also a prankster, right? And you don't know if he's in town or not, but you do know that you have this friend. And so you think, okay, well, what are the odds that my friend, the prankster, rolled this boulder here and left the bow on top of it? You think, well, the odds that, given this strange occurrence in here, the odds of this happening, given that my friend being in town, much more likely. And so the argument from beauty is could be a bit like this, where you could just say that this is, beauty is an unexplained kind of phenomenon, the great amounts of beauty. So which better kind of explains it, naturalism or theism? On theism, it just seems much more likely. Now, a counter objection, so something that you find in E.O. Wilson and others, you know, is that given that the human species evolved within this world, we just kind of have evolved to appreciate the forms of beauty that, you know, where we grew up, just kind of like we all like our mom's cooking, whether or not she's the best cook, because it's what we grew up with. That might be sort of an explanation for this. And so there are various stories about how, you know, we appreciate beauty because early humans needed to be attentive to the shift in times of day, to sunsets, so they knew when to sort of seek shelter, or we are all just kind of attracted to the forms of life that are hospitable to human survival, like the, you know, the African savanna with its particular proportions. And that's a possible explanation, but it's not a very compelling explanation, given that our experience of beauty seems to me that we're often as attracted to and interested in forms of beauty that are hostile to our survival, you know, bright berries that are poisonous, you know, very high waterfalls that if we climbed up them, we could fall to our death, or fierce creatures that, you know, could eat us alive. And so this biophilia hypothesis, I think, is really not very compelling.
Earlier, you said that beauty is objective. So how do you explain the various disagreements about, you know, what is beautiful, including artworks? And is artistic and aesthetic beauty particular to, let's say, the Western mindset versus other cultures who might have a completely different idea of something that is aesthetic and beautiful that we don't think is beautiful? For instance, you know, there's various different people groups that have traditions that Westerners would find, you know, gross or something like that, where they find a lot of beauty in it. So how is something like this really relevant to any type of person in any culture?
Well, yeah. And Melanie, you bring up a really great point. And I think this is one of the cases where our objections to objective beauty are kind of grounded in some ways in our desire to be sensitive, to be aware that there are different sensibilities and other cultures have different perspectives. So in some ways, the objection to objective beauty, you know, can derive from almost a moral impulse, right? Well, I don't like, it seems unfair to rank people one more beautiful than the other. That's odd. Or seems like maybe you're being exclusive, you know, if you hold up Western art as being the pinnacle of human creation at the expense of other cultures that have their own distinctive forms of beauty. So maybe there's an argument to be made here that in order to be kind of appropriately humble in our cultural perspectives, we should deny objective beauty. Now, I think that that's a fine impulse, but not a particularly compelling one, simply because I think, we could square the two and say that, my attunement to, say, the forms of sort of Japanese art or whatever is fairly limited. I've spent some time learning kind of haiku and studying some of the poetry of Basho, one of the great writers of haiku. And so I've learned a bit more about the sort of uniqueness of this art form beyond just what young people kind of imitate in school. And so I think I'm a little more attuned to that. But then there are other forms, traditional Japanese forms of dramatic enactment are very strange to me, and I just can't kind of make sense of them, right? Because they're kind of culturally formed. But I'm sure if I spent more time interacting with them, studying them, I would grow to appreciate the, things that are aesthetically good about them. And, there are these different sensibilities. So one of the things people talk about, and I keep bringing up Japanese work, because that's where I've done a little bit more studying, but they talk about this sort of wabi-sabi sensibility, that whereas Western art aims at kind of completeness and balance, wabi-sabi aims, is interested in incompleteness, things being spare, unusual. And that too, I think, is something that if we kind of cultivate a taste for it, we can see ways that it is also aesthetically good. So I think what our interactions with different forms of beauty show is that beauty is not just a natural innate sense that we have. It's not like it's just our gut instinct. We have to cultivate and develop our appreciation for beauty sort of over time, much in the same way that we can't appreciate higher forms of mathematics naturally. You have to spend time kind of learning lists, embedding yourself kind of within this world from practicing and so forth before you can really understand it. Or the same would go for understanding writing in a different language or anything. We have some basic senses of aesthetic goodness, but in order to appreciate higher work, it takes time and acculturation and practice, and sometimes weeding out bad taste. And so the same thing goes when we're moving across cultures as well. Just the more we spend, we can learn to appreciate. Now, that's not to say that everything every culture appreciates is aesthetically good or highly beautiful. I think there are parts of American culture, there are things that we're fascinated by that are bad. Right? We like bad things sometimes, or just for various reasons. We've kind of grown to appreciate certain forms of art that are either just not important or not good. And so I'm not saying that kind of all forms of artistic expression are equally valid, far from it, because someone who's looking in from the outside, the kind of the Martian or the outsider looking into American culture, might think that's really strange. These people really seem to like this, terrible television show. It's not very funny. It's not very deep. It's got a laugh track, but it must be really good because they all seem to like it. Well, no, that's just sometimes people have bad taste, or we just enjoy kind of cheap and easy entertainments over higher and better ones.
Traditionally, when people talked about beauty and art and aesthetics, it was more grounded in, art history. Let's say you were just talking about different kinds of art, for example, Japanese art. But the average person or even the average Christian doesn't really have a working knowledge anymore about art. I mean, the early church for sure used art extensively in terms of depicting various religious scenes. And through, church history and art history, it's been used to portray biblical events or whatnot. But the average person doesn't really go to museums anymore. So what would be other things besides nature or maybe human beauty that people could point to as beautiful if they're to use this argument when they're talking to friends outside of, some of the traditional arguments apologists would use?
Yeah, so, well, there are different versions of the argument. So the ones that I offered initially were kind of, I think, the most basic ones, which is we look at the world around us, it almost looks like a painting. Therefore, we move to thinking about kind of a creator as being a painter, right? That's a natural move. But we could also say that just our sense of beauty, it could count as an argument for God's existence. And so Alvin Plantinga and his work, he's talked about this idea that, you know, well, it seems like there are things that are very beautiful, right? Not just the natural world, but also, you know, Mozart concerto or something like that. And we have this kind of basic belief, you know, that this is beautiful, right? It's a very common sense position to hold. It's a natural thing. It's not just that I'm experiencing some feeling when I listen to this, but actually this thing has this property or some such thing. It's, there's a quality of the thing itself that it is beautiful. But, you know, it's, well, why do we have this sense, right? Why can we trust our faculties to produce true judgments about, you know, something basic like this? On evolution, maybe having a, you know, true sense of the beautiful, sort of true tracking sense of the beautiful is not necessary for survival. Maybe it's not conducive for survival. So if evolution is basically, unguided evolution is the only source for the human person, then maybe we can't trust the sense of the beautiful. And so therefore we have to look elsewhere if we want to maintain the kind of truthfulness of our aesthetic sensibilities. And so one could mount a kind of an argument for God from our sense of something being beautiful. Now it's a little bit more of a tricky argument because again, a lot of people will just deny beauty's objectivity. So it only really works if you've gotten someone to the point where they're willing to accept that objective beauty exists. And so one could mount an argument that way. And I think that that's actually a really interesting way. It's more fitting certainly with what I think should be the Christian perspective. And that's ultimately where I keep wanting to come back to, is that it's really valuable to mount, you know, philosophical objections and so forth and give people things to think about. People want to know just that the Christian worldview is true and trustworthy. They're going to invest their lives in it. But we also want to make sure that our arguments really fit with the kind of the tenor and the language of Scripture. What you find in Scripture is, you know, right from the very beginning in the creation account, God creates a world that's ordered, it's filled with life, and God calls it good, right? And that language there is very interesting, which is, it's not that God sort of simply says, it is good, this thing that I have done, right? Or people should call this good. He says, it is good. Right? He declares it good. And that declaration is kind of a statement about the world that he's created. And then the Hebrew and the Greek version of the Old Testament, the word for good there has this much bigger holistic meaning than being morally good. It's about things possessing kind of an overall goodness, including being beautiful. And then, of course, when humans are created, it's the world is very good. There's this kind of excellence to it. And you find other versions of kind of the argument from beauty in Scripture. So, you know, we find the psalmist, you know, saying kind of considering the work of your hands, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim his work, they pour forth speech and reveal knowledge. That's Psalm 19. There's this way that the Bible affirms, as it were, this argument from beauty by saying, when you look up the world around us, it just seems like you should get the clue that God is behind the scenes and that the creation itself declares God's glory.
So should Christians take this subject of beauty seriously? I think there are some Christians that particularly think that aesthetics are frivolous and can lead to ungodliness. And so how should a Christian even consider this subject, or vanity? Looking at something pleasing, even if it's a person, and acknowledging their looks, is to be vain, to be focusing on the material, something that Christians shouldn't be doing.
That is also, in some sense, a scriptural response. You know, Paul talks about this kind of modesty that we're to have. And I do think there's a distinctive way that Christians will show interest in beauty and in the arts. And so it's not just that there's kind of good taste, or our account of taste is the same as what the wider culture, secular culture would affirm. There's distinctive Christian taste. There are certain forms of beauty and ways of expression that I think we want to be specially attuned to and to exhibit. So I'd expect for Christians to, if they care about dressing, to still dress differently than people out in the wider world. So I would affirm in some sense that what I sense behind the objection to beauty as a kind of a concern that we not simply adopt kind of the cultural perspective on beauty or superficiality. There are deeper forms of beauty that the Christian is attuned to, right? Even inner spiritual beauty that we pay attention to. But I don't think that that's just a kind of a metaphor. I think that there really is something attractive about someone who has this holiness that, you know, kind of radiates from them. And so somebody like a Hans Urs von Balthasar says, you know, the most beautiful thing in the world is the life of a saint, right? Well, that's a distinctive, he's not talking about someone's body, right? Or their fashion, or even the, you know, Olympian who can do incredible, amazing things. He's saying the most beautiful thing in the world is the life of a human created in God's image who now is reflecting the likeness of Christ. Like, that's actually the most beautiful thing that you can perceive. I think that that points to a different sensibility about aesthetics that Christians should have, right? We're attuned to different sorts of things. But if you deny the importance of beauty and ornamentation, you're really going against Scripture, right? God declares the creation beautiful. God also commands that his work, so his tabernacle and his temple, you know, be ornamented, and the best craftsmen kind of create this in a certain way. So God cares about artistry. It's just that it has to have godly priorities behind it instead of worldly priorities.
I think that's still, you know, hard for some Christians to grapple with, because they've really been taught that things that are aesthetic are worldly. All of them are arts. You know, it's been the age-old kind of struggle for the person who is artistic, or the people who appreciate arts, to try to, you know, have a flourishing spiritual life in the church. Or I'm talking more, you know, recently, not centuries ago, or the art was more a part of the church. But how do you address that? Because a lot of time the arts in aesthetics in any form outside of creation that you see are deemed as being worldly.
Well, I think I'm typically pretty unpersuaded. I would just say I haven't met many people who I think are terribly consistent about such things. Of course, you know, something people often have in mind when they're thinking about the arts is they're worried about sort of slipping into back into a what you might, you know, kind of see as a sort of a pre-Reformation, you know, image culture of the church, which, you know, has devolved almost into kind of superstition or some such thing as that, where you have, you know, these images are really these kind of necessary pieces of worship. And against this, of course, many of the reformers objected, and you have a whole kind of wave of iconoclasm that has infused a lot of Protestant aesthetics since. Now, I think that that's changed to a good degree. Almost all churches that, you know, I'm aware of, even ones that, you know, are Protestant, do incorporate works of artistry kind of throughout. So they have worship music. So aesthetics are important there. They still do have a kind of a distinctive style of, you know, architecture, trying to convey certain things through their building spaces. And a lot of people, even if they don't have stained glass windows, now use PowerPoint and slides and movie clips in their worship. And so I would be very interested to meet the person who had a thoroughgoing and consistent objection to imaging or to aesthetics as being kind of unhelpful. Normally, it seems that when people are objecting to aesthetics broadly, what they really have in mind is just some specific problem that the church has a more nuanced response to. So we can avoid specific problems without throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
So would you say that this is only something that philosophers talk about? You know, you just mentioned that Christians should consider it. I mean, how can they practically consider this topic and find out more, or really consider the argument from beauty, if they haven't really thought about it before?
Well, I think the best way for, you know, these kind of apologetic arguments to work themselves out is not so much in, you know, trying to have a particularly philosophical argument. Most people aren't philosophers. Those who are, or even those who are interested in some such things, you know, often aren't going to be kind of able to really, you know, hash that out. I think the best place to start is really just to begin with the fundamental insights that you're relying on, which is, you know, wow, like, this world is really good and beautiful. I mean, that's a fundamental movement of the soul in wonder, right? And if we can help other people to also, you know, move their souls likewise in such wonder, then they've begun to kind of exercise, I think, an appropriate response to God's creation. And that is a wonderful starting point for having a meaningful discussion, right? Where we're sort of wondering together about this world that we're experiencing. Is this world an accidental collection of atoms in motion, or is it designed, right? Is it created? I think that's a really a good discussion that one can have together, you know, with almost anyone, you know, based on our experience. You can kind of just move from there. Aristotle says all philosophy begins in wonder, and I think that what's excellent about wonder as a starting point is that it's not just curiosity, right? Well, why is this the case? There's also a kind of an experience of value, right? Okay, this thing that I'm presented with is amazing. It naturally causes me to think, but then I also experience gratitude toward the world. And so in the same way that, you know, we thank people for gifts on our birthday, you know, we should also then naturally give thanks to God for the gift of birth, right? If you're a thankful person, I think you're going to be naturally moved to be open to sort of reflecting on the reason that we're here. So I think that's a good place to begin with. And so I would want all Christians to exemplify kind of attitudes of thankfulness, of curiosity that's arising from wonder at the world that God has made.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have some fun rapid fire questions for Phil. So Phil, what is something new that you learned recently?
That's a great question. Well, I've been watching the Olympics. I was surprised to see some of the other, you know, obviously I don't watch the Olympics very much. I mean, I learned that there are some of these new sports have been added. So watching the kind of things that I thought were the X Games, you know, sort of BMX, BMX biking and skateboarding, that was a surprise. I even learned, I didn't realize that men did the floor routine in the Olympics, and was kind of interested to watch how the men's floor routine differed from the women's gymnastic floor routine. The women get to have a lot more fun in their floor routine. The men just kind of, you know, sort of move to the corner and then just do the next flip.
You know, when we were having our discussion, I actually thought, when you're thinking about beauty, of the Olympics, because even if art is something that doesn't move you, or theater or music, I think most humans are pretty amazed at what the human body can do when we see the Olympics. There's some, even in, you know, sports like gymnastics or running or track and field or something like that, there's some gracefulness and wonder, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I think somebody tweeted that before every Olympic event, they should have a normal person go out and try and do the thing just to get a proper comparison. Because if I went out and tried to, you know, do the pole vault or the pommel horse, you know, it would look horrible. And then the next person would come up and everyone would just be in awe at the incredible training and virtuosity of these.
Or even the BMX biking. I mean, that takes a lot of guts and, you know, fearlessness to do some of that stuff. Well, fill in the blank here. I've had enough of.
I think like everybody, I've had enough of COVID. We're heading back, and I'm ready to be over with that. So that's what I'll leave it with. I've had enough of COVID. I'm ready to close this chapter and move on to the next one.
Well, given COVID and just kind of the state in the last, you know, 18 months to 2 years, have you visited any new places recently?
Yeah. So we haven't gotten out, you know, too much. We did this summer get up to North Carolina and discovered some new hikes that we hadn't gone on before. We're big fans of hiking, and that's one of the nice things about being up there is there's always a new place to go and to explore.
Well, thanks, Phil, for being on the 250th episode of the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Well, I appreciate it. Maybe I can be on episode 10,000 when you get that far. So.
Oh, I don't know. Are we both going to be alive then?
We shall see. I'll have to start, you know, staying in shape so I can make it there.
You've been listening to episode 250 of the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Dr. Philip Tallon, who has written a feature article for the upcoming Volume 44, Number 3, issue, and it's called From Beauty to the Beatific Vision, Recovering the Argument from Beauty. You can read his article when you subscribe to our magazine at our website, equip.org. We'd like to connect to you, so please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man YouTube channel and join in the conversation in the comments section and in the live chat when we have premiere videos. Please follow the Bible Answer Man page on Facebook and on Twitter. You will find us at Hank Hanegraaff, Bible Answer Man, Christian Research Institute, and Christian Research Journal, as well as on Instagram at the Bible Answer Man account. You won't want to miss every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern when we live stream the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff at our website, equip.org. In addition, please subscribe to the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank gets out of the studio and into his study and engages in in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. You'll want to head on over to equip.org because there you're going to find thousands of free resources for you in articles and past broadcasts, our podcasts, and videos. And thank you for all the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute.